important things to say about the U.S. in terms of context. Of course, we all know that it is an economic powerhouse. It's the military superpower, the global engine of technological development, one of the oldest democracies in the world. But it's also an extremely diverse nation. It is a nation of indigenous peoples, slaves, and immigrants. It's a nation of diverse opinions and views, sometimes so strongly held that it once slid into civil war. It's also a nation of resilience and struggle, and home of one of the 20th century's most inspiring moments encapsulated by the civil rights movement. So there's many, many things that go on. Now, clearly in assessing freedom of assembly and association, one has to look at the enabling environment that allows these rights to be exercised. And in this country, it is impossible to look at these issues without going into issues of racism and racial discrimination. It's at the core of the most recent protests you have seen, and it's an issue that has to be dealt with in understanding and in assessing right to freedom of association and assembly. My focus is not race, nor is it discrimination. My mandate is about the enjoyment of rights of peaceful assembly and association. But you have to go through the question of racism and exclusion, persecution, and marginalization that come with racism that affect the enabling environment for the exercise of these rights. So historically, we can go back into the context of slavery and the more than 400 years of painful slavery and what it meant to the black community here. Then after that, you have the Civil War that got freedom for slaves. But soon after, a few years after after freedom and after Reconstruction, the Jim Crow laws came in. And what I'm trying to say is that all these periods have an impact and have significance to the current understanding of how freedom of association and assembly is exercised today. So even though slavery is no more, even though Jim Crow laws are no more, there are structures of exclusion and discrimination that still affect these rights. And nowadays, they don't have specific, clear racial terminology. We have euphemisms that are being used. For example, the war on drugs that was started by the Reagan administration here, and which from that war on drugs has led to the largest incarcerations of people across the world, of which a significant proportion of that of those people in jail are African Americans. One out of every 15 black men is in jail. One out of every 13 African Americans has lost their right to vote. So you see a whole set of discrimination that then affects people's rights to assemble. We have had since then as well an aggressive emphasis on law and order, or what they like to call broken windows approach in policing, which again has led to systematic discrimination and harassment, but has also led to a lot more convictions and incarcerations. So the other factor, I think, in terms of understanding the whole setup, is the Bill Clinton administration's federal three strikes you're out law, which again has contributed to the exclusion and incarceration, fueling discontent and anger. So you've got the whole system that makes it difficult for people, first of all, to protest, because the three strikes you're out might mean that you're held in jail for a long time. So people with convictions for small crimes, sometimes sometimes even arrests, have difficulty working, have difficulty getting a public housing, have difficulty getting their lives together, and then that then translates into hampering the right to associate and to assemble. Interestingly, though, one of the things that I find interesting is that we know that in this country we had the Wall Street bankers looted billions of dollars through crooked schemes and devastated almost the economy of this country. We never heard of a war on Wall Street theft. We've never heard that. So in a sense, we have had a war that seems to target poor people and people who are already disenfranchised and weakened and marginalized. These are the things that have then led to the Black Lives Matter movement. And I need to make it clear for me, it's clear that Black Lives Matter does not mean that other lives, whether they are green, they are purple, they are blue or white, do not matter. The Black Lives Matter movement is simply a reaffirmation that black lives do in fact matter in the face of a structure that is systematically devalues and destroys them, stretching back hundreds of years. It's not about granting African Americans special status or privilege. It's about a historically and continuously targeted community seeking to elevate itself to the same level that everyone else enjoys. But it's not all about racial inequality. It's also about economic inequality that exists, and the gap that's going on between the rich and the poor, with productivity up, output up, but the wages of average people have not increased. They have stagnated. So this exacerbates inequality because, again, a lot of those affected are the African American, the marginalized communities, the brown and the black, as was being said a lot. So people have good reason to be angry and frustrated. And it's at times like these when robust promotion of assembly and association rights are needed the most. Because people need a peaceful avenue to speak out. They need an avenue to engage in dialogue and with their citizens and with authorities, but also air their grievances and hopefully settle them. And especially important at a time when people's rights to participate in other forms such as voting is limited because they're migrants or they're felons. I have to say that one of the clear things for me that I've taken out of this visit is really a strong sense of admiration for the grassroots activists, for the CSOs, for the workers who are gathering and working, for their resilience, for their courage, and especially for their belief that there can be a better US, a better America. And I think that's one of the most fascinating and most important parts of it, that people have not given up, which is why they're protesting, which is why they'll keep on protesting. I think that's a great attribute to this country as it exists. Going now to some of the rights. In terms of peaceful assembly, I mentioned quite a few things about some of the inhibitions that broadly hurt the freedom of assembly. I think, but looking at first of all the legal framework, it's important to stress that the U.S. law focuses primarily on the free speech aspects of freedom of assembly, the content-based approach. Now, international human rights law, in terms of freedom of assembly, is mostly about process and trying to give the space for the protest. So we have these time, place, and manner restrictions that have been authorized by courts and authorities which have been placed, and these do not necessarily conform with international law. So that the right of peaceful assembly is a right on its own, different from right of expression, and it guarantees that people may conduct assemblies. Restrictions to this right must meet international human rights law standards. So they should be narrow and they should be rare. And it's up to the authorities to explain when they put these restrictions, why they're doing so, rather than the person seeking to enjoy their rights to assembly. It's also a country where largely to participate in assembly, you need a permit. They call it permits here, other places they call it authorizations. International legal standards, international law, human rights law standards recommend that a system of notification is what is required, which where you notify the authorities that you're going to do a protest or an assembly, and then authorities to allow them to plan and to organize themselves to be able to facilitate that assembly. When you require permission, then you have turned the right into a privilege. Because rights do not need permission from anybody to be exercised. Granted, there are very few instances in recent times where protests have not been allowed, permits have not been issued. But what you have is when you apply for a permit, you find that your space is severely restricted sometimes by the authorities to make sure that it's difficult. I was in Philadelphia yesterday, and it was interesting that the requirement to obtain a permit is not always rigidly enforced, but of course then that opens a process to arbitrariness and uncertainty and discretion that is quite there. On the policing of assemblies, it is clear that most of the police forces in this country understand and know how to police assemblies properly when they want to do so. They know how to do it. Sometimes they do it. Often they do, actually. They often do respect the best methods, best practices in managing assemblies, but sometimes they don't. And that's when that's when the troubles start, when the police decide deliberately to use intimidatory and discriminative tactics. It was disturbing to learn that assemblies organized by African Americans are often managed differently, with these protests often met with disproportionate force. In fact, white and Muslim activists that I met acknowledged that black fellow protesters face harsher police encounters in the context of assemblies, and police are more likely to be militarized and aggressive. Black people are detained longer after arrest. They face more and heavier charges, more intimidation, and more disrespect. All this, of course, adds to discontent and frustration and resentment, and it's disconcerting that 2 years after what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, after the killing of Michael Brown, and after the crisis in Baltimore after the shooting of Freddie Gray, just this month in Baton Rouge, following the killing of Alton Sterling, the police in Baton Rouge responded in very similar ways as those in Baltimore and in Ferguson. It is absolutely manifestly unwise to respond to a largely peaceful, grieving crowd with riot gear, random arrests, flimsy charges, rough physical handling, verbal insults, and other things like that. It is not only a violation to the right of peaceful assembly, but it's dangerous to the participants, the general public, and the police officers. As I said, a lot of police know what is right, and I would like to say that I've met quite a few police who expressed very clearly the appropriate way of policing assemblies, the appropriate way of de-escalating when tensions are rising, and I need to single out the Washington DC Metropolitan Police, who know exactly what to do when it comes to protests. Jackson, Mississippi Police, New Orleans Police also displayed a good understanding, and in fact, the Jackson, Mississippi Police have a very good reputation in terms of the way they do their policing. So these are things that are happening and are doing well. There's also issues about intimidation by law enforcement. I got testimonies from members of the Black Lives Matter who complained of officers from the FBI going to their homes to warn them against taking part in protests, especially around in Cleveland, around the Republican National Convention moment. Alana Bell was told how her parents were visited when she was not there, and a colleague from Amnesty International was also visited by FBI around these protests around the conventions. This targeting is a form of intimidation. It does not bode well for people. Moreover, immigration, customs, and enforcement agents are also getting involved in these intimidation practices. And I heard about instances when it comes to migrant workers in Phoenix, Arizona, and New Orleans, where ICE agents attend assemblies and are involved in intimidating migrant workers when they want to assemble. Homeless people and people working homeless are also often targeted, and I heard about that in Philadelphia and also in DC and in New York City, about where homeless people are being targeted for and being charged simply for gathering together. Surveillance of protests is an issue. Yesterday, I was at the Black Lives Matter protest observing it in Philadelphia, and it was fascinating to see an undercover police officer in the group marching with the demonstrators and filming them, which of course makes people very angry and agitated. And it was really a miracle that there was no serious crisis or chaos following that incident of the undercover police. But it's also where police have like everybody else have a right to record what's going on, where they turn that recording into a tool of intimidation. When they come smacking people's faces and shove the cameras, two of them in your face, you know, letting you know that they're recording you, and you have no idea where that film is going to go, where that footage is going to go. It's a serious form of intimidation. It is something that, in fact, police should only be filming at protests when they are recording an actual crime in progress. We also have a series which happens in many countries across the world. So it's surprising it happens in the USA, where authorities use petty charges and high number of arrests to chill and undermine the right to peaceful assembly. Protesters talk of being arrested and charged with obstructing traffic, failure to obey a police officer, resisting arrest, and then these charges then appear on protesters' criminal records with devastating effects such as job losses, inability to get public housing, and more. Exercising a human right should not cause such domino effects into misery. And I think that's one of the big problems you're having, is that with all this three strikes you're out, war on drugs and other and the broken windows philosophy of policing, you've got people now getting less and less sure about their ability to protest and get out on the streets. The issue, again, I've talked about the wide discretion of law enforcement officers to arrest, detain, formulate charges, do whatever they want with you. And these are challenges towards freedom of assembly. I want to say I was struck by the lack of sufficient oversight and accountability mechanisms around police issues in this country. First of all, the discretion that each police, the 18,000 police forces have got, leads to an inconsistent approach to policing of assemblies and of people around assemblies. So you find differences from one jurisdiction to the neighboring one. So for example, in Jackson, Mississippi, the police chief is widely lauded by the African American community because of how he does policing. Right next door is a county which has got a totally different approach, which focuses on broken taillights, which focuses on if you don't stop strong enough at the stop sign or long enough a stop sign, you're going to be stopped and frisked and things like that. So all these things just creates more and more animosity rather than helping. So I think there's some issues around here. And now, of course, the introduction of under the whole genesis of Blue Lives Matter, of a special classification of offenses against police as hate crimes, therefore with bigger consequences, is going to make things probably much worse. This has already passed in Louisiana, and Philadelphia, I think, has just passed similar legislation as well. What it means is that a protester who has a scuffle with a police officer in the middle of a protest may be accused of battery, and then that becomes a hate crime, which then adds on to this whole sense of incarceration and the sense of punishment for really minor things that need not to be there. I had a long, good meeting with the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, and everywhere I've gone where there has been consent agreements and consent decrees with the Civil Rights Division, you've found an improvement in the way the policing works. It's imperative that this Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice is strengthened, is given more resources so it can actually go and provide oversight to the more than 18,000 police of law enforcement jurisdictions that exist in this country. The only way you can do that, you can get an effective, more people-friendly policing then that will then reduce tensions between police and communities, is if there's an oversight mechanism that exists. Finally, for me, I think there are two last points. One is that it's been impossible to get accurate figures from the government of the United States about the number of people shot by the police in this country and the circumstances and follow-up actions. In fact, the most accurate forms of data now is from the Guardian newspaper of the UK, and I think Washington Post. The police have no data. It is incomprehensible that a nation like this will not provide data about the actions of police. It's these kinds of things that give us, the police, a sense of impunity, that they can get away with anything as they go. Finally, on assembly, I've got to talk about the issue of guns and open carrying guns or concealed carriage of guns. I know this is a country that values its guns and carrying them around. But in a context where there's tension, where there's discontent with policing, there's real tensions in society, the idea that some people in a protest or bystanders or in a counter-protest may have concealed weapons is a very scary one. When we were told of cases where in Ferguson, where protesters testified to me about the fear, the experience when some people who were calling themselves oath keepers went up the top of the roof of the police station while they're protesting on the street. That sense of fear is intense. In fact, the police themselves told me how difficult and scary it is for them to police and protect protesters who are in the context of weapons being allowed. They don't know whether protesters have got guns. They don't know whether bystanders have got guns. They don't know who has got a gun. And so they are very nervous as they police the protests. I think there's something that the U.S. should not allow fear to define the parameters of organizing or managing protests. Right to association, and I'm trying to go as fast as I can so you can have some questions, but there's a lot of stuff as you can hear. Now, the right to association in the context I've focused a lot on labor, and I used labor very broadly because it's also about unionization, but also other associations of workers and being allowed and them being allowed to organize and associate. There's a lot of challenges around the right to form unions and the right and the robust protections of labor rights. Very often, many states, both at the federal level, but also at the state and local levels, may talk about that they are neutral when it comes to unionization. However, international human rights law demands that when you have a right, that the state has a duty to not only respect it, but to also protect and facilitate its enjoyment. The state cannot be neutral when it comes to human rights, including the right to unionize. The state must indeed take a position which is in favor of workers coming together to unionize or associate in any way that they wish to do so. There's limited resources for the enforcement of labor standards and a general lack of political will to strengthen these standards. I've divided this into three parts. One is migrant workers. In migrant workers, we talk about documented and undocumented, skilled and unskilled, seasonal or long-term. But migrant workers are routinely subjected to harassment, intimidation, physical, sexual, and psychological abuse, especially with those attempting to form or belong to unions, or organizations being especially targeted for reprisals. It's one of those most difficult things where a migrant worker, especially an undocumented migrant worker, who finds that they are in a quandary. They're being exploited, but they can't organize. Each time they try and protest or come together, the employer says, "We're going to get ICE onto you, Immigration and Customs," so that they seems it's fine for them to work as long as they accept being exploited. So all these things have become a challenge, and I think it's one of the things that we've got to be clear as well, that all international law recognizes that everybody has rights, whether you're legal or illegal. Your rights don't stop at the border when you're crossing in. You go on with your rights under international human rights law. So they have rights. Undocumented workers have rights to protest, to associate, to do anything else that others can do. Indeed, because they have no other protection, it is primarily important that their right to assembly and association is especially protected because they have no other recourse. So that is a need to separate the immigration from the labor context. And as long as immigration and labor come hand in hand, we've got a huge issue and a problem in terms of defending and protecting rights. But it's not just undocumented. Even those who are documented have difficulties. I met teachers from the Philippines brought into the state of Louisiana on H-1B visas, and they eventually filed a case which the court found that they had been trafficked from Philippines to the United States. And because once they had a recruitment agency, many of them took out loans to be able to fill up the forms and facilitate. They called it facilitation fee and recruitment fee and other fees that they were paying. So they come into the U.S. and then they find that they are caught and held up under very, very difficult circumstances. Their solution emerged after they joined a union and they fought a struggle, so that now they've got status as trafficked people and they can eventually get residency in the United States, which is one of the cases where you find the benefits of unionization helping to solve some of the issues. It's worse for seasonal or guest workers on H-2B visas who are seen as the unskilled workers. I met a lot of them who, especially around the seafood industry in Louisiana, where again it's essentially a system of pure exploitation. Visas are typically tied to one employer who exercises immense control over the employee. if you start talking about organizing, they threaten to call immigration or terminate your contract there and then. And you find that it becomes very difficult, it's very exploitative. Indeed, I found that this system, especially around seasonal guest workers, is quite similar to the kafala system that you find in the Gulf region, in the Gulf region of the Middle East. It's a system that the US should not be having when it talks about democracy. So ICE, the issue of ICE is one that kept coming up around how ICE works in enforcing it, how they work with local police, and sometimes where they're brought in when there's a labor dispute so that they can then support the cause of the employer rather than the worker. Labor unions, that is a big. This was a big part of some of the things that I was looking at. Workers are not prevented from forming unions, theoretically. However, in practice, the ability to form and join unions is impeded by a number of factors. The inordinate deference given to employers to undermine union formation, a so-called neutral stand on unions by authorities, when in fact international law requires that they facilitate unions, weak remedies and penalties for intimidation, coercion, and undue influence by employers, and political interference and overt support for industry, for employers at the expense of workers. Employers can hold captive audience meetings to try and dissuade, quote-unquote, dissuade workers from joining a union. But workers have no right to distribute union literature at the workplace or conduct meetings without the management being present or engage in protest activity without on the employer's property. And of course, around this is the pervasive union busting industry, which is apparently worth about $4 billion a year in this country. So I was in Mississippi. I went to meet workers from the Nissan plant, where they have been unable to form a union, where the management is directly, aggressively working to dissuade and stop formation of a union at the Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi. So much so, in fact, that there's now some people now calling are saying that Mississippi is the Mexico, is the new Mexico in. Because of cheap labor that happens there. The fact that Mississippi is selling itself as a destination of employment because unions are not employed is an issue of concern. What is even more shocking for me is that Nissan Renault, the joint company, has about 40 plants across the world, and all of them are unionized except the one in Mississippi. Even the one in South Africa is unionized. Brazil is, Japan, France, everywhere they're unionized except in Mississippi. It does not help the issue of freedom of association. So there's a lot of issues around land, around labor, which I hope that you'll be able to see when you get a copy of the statement. But let me just finish off by looking at counterterrorism issues in the context of assembly and association rights. I think this is an important one because there's a lot of issues around counterterrorism. Now, all of us, of course, understand and appreciate how different a world this is, how sometimes scary it is to be in a world where terrorism can happen at any moment. But it's absolutely fundamental that in dealing with terrorism, the fundamental rights of human beings are protected, including the right to association and of assembly. We should not forfeit these rights in the name of counterterrorism. In fact, if anything, we need to keep them going because it provides people with an open and peaceful way of addressing grievances. In this context, for example, we found that there's prohibitions from the Patriot Act and before that prohibit providing a wide range of support, but does so in a way that jeopardizes the right. For example, the Patriot Act imperils the work of associations providing critical peace training to actors suspected to be related to terrorism. So even work that is trying to move people away from terrorism ends up being classified as something illegal. It complicates the work of humanitarian organizations where terrorist actors are active and makes grant makers very nervous about how they provide grants because there may be somebody somewhere may be linked. There's a number of things around that. My attention was drawn to the partner vetting system that the USAID and State Department are beginning to roll out. Where they're trying it out now in 5 countries, which is Guatemala, Kenya, Lebanon, Philippines, and Ukraine, where the where the grantees of USAID are going to be required to vet every single partner of that they come in touch with to make sure they're not terrorists at all. Now, this may very well lead to a system where local partners believe that they're being used by US authorities to gather intelligence and may compromise existing and future working relationships with these partners. It is not a necessary system to have. There are so many groups that are working and providing donor assistance without having to go through the system of vetting that is being proposed. There's a new system, there's a new idea as well being called the Joint Strategy on Countering Violent Extremism, again introduced in May 2016 in State Department, but being tested out as well in the US in certain cities, which aims at preventing the radicalization and recruitment of individuals by violent extremists. Again, this may not is not stated that it's focused on any particular ethnic, religious, or racial group, but it is. But if history is any indicator, it is there's fears that this will be mainly targeted at members of the Muslim community, and has the potential to impact adversely on the enjoyment of their rights of assembly and association. A lot of this seems to be driven by what has been implemented in the UK and what they call the PREVENT program, which has targeted basically Muslim youth in the UK, but which has been targeting them in a way that makes Muslim youth more, that creates apprehension and tension among Muslim youth, because the indicators are very, very broad. I when I was in the UK on mission earlier this year, I met a young man who said he had been put through the program of PREVENT simply because he had a bracelet that said Free Palestine, and he was then seen as perhaps being at risk of being radicalized, and then therefore taken through the program, which then of course begins to stigmatize people at a very early age. It is imperative that any strategy to counter terrorism, extremism, has very narrow parameters, but it's also based on scientific research and involves a broad range of civil society organizations in its formulation, implementation, and oversight. I mean, that's got to be the key thing that goes on. So I've talked about infiltration and surveillance, which I think is going on, and there are many cases around that where there are even suggestions of entrapment by FBI so that they can have a case of success. Let me leave it there and say that partly I think one of the things that one finds here is the lack of alternative structures to the courts to find accountability. And in certain places I went, there was very government officials were very quick to tell me that if someone doesn't like the decision somebody takes, you can go to court. It's not enough to say I can breach your rights and then you can go to court. You should be stopping it from breaching the rights before you seek your rights in court. And in addition, the whole process of access to justice is one that is a very broad issue in this country and many other countries. It's expensive. It also is exclusionary for those who are poor and those who are also scared of using a system using the court system as their primary way to seek accountability and to hold governments accountable. Thank you very much, and I'm so sorry I've taken so long. And for those of you who are awake, thank you very much for being awake.
Thank you, Mr. Kiai. We'll open the floor to questions now. And Mr. Kiai, how would you prefer to do it? Do you want to take two or three questions at a time?
Let's take a few.
So why don't we'll take three questions at a time. And for those of you on the phone, we will start in the room, and we'll take three questions from the room first, and then we will go to the phone in the next round of questions. So I'd ask everyone to please identify yourselves and your organization as you ask your questions, please. The floor is open. So we'll start on this side and make our way around.
My name is Sarah Taylor. I'm with the Associated Press. What kind of extra organizations would you suggest outside of the courts to prevent violations of rights?
Great. And question here.
You spoke about intimidation by police. Did you have any meetings or address anything about the targeting of police that's happened recently here in the United States?
I'm sorry, could you identify yourself and your organization?
I'm sorry, I'm Penny Starr with CNS News.
Great. Thank you. And do we have any further questions in the room? Why don't we have Mr. Kiai take those two questions in the room, and then we will turn to the phones.
Okay. I suppose the first thing that you want to do is to avoid violating people's rights in the first place, and do everything you can to not violate the rights. I think an approach that says, look, if you're not happy, go to the courts, is one that almost perpetuates violations of rights. So that's what the first part is, an attitude change that is necessary. You know, let's move away from saying, you don't like it, if I arrest you badly, go to the courts. So I think that's the first part. But there are many systems you can have that are in between, that before you get to the courts. One is you can have this various ombudsman type of roles, and many countries have got the national human rights institutions that are created where people can have an interlocutor that can deal and help with these things before you get to the level of courts. Courts are generally expensive, they're time consuming, so you're trying to find ways in which accountability can be sought before you have to expend all that money and all that time. Lawyers, especially in this country, are not a dime a dozen, they cost a lot of money. So you're basically excluding a lot of people when you start saying, if the police beat you at a protest, go to court, and it just also turns the burden of proof, because you're the one who has to prove now that you're beaten rather than the other way around. So there are a number of things that can be done that shouldn't be happening. So there's, within the context of policing, often they have civilian oversight bodies that you can make reports to. The police, I think, in every police department that I talk to, all have internal affairs type of bodies that are police. But I think in many countries now you're finding other bodies that are not part of the police force, independent of the police, where you can put complaints and push the system forward before you even think about going to court. So I'm recommending, yes, that indeed there should be those other systems that don't go, not before you end up in court. Otherwise, you have logjam in courts as well. And for those who can't afford, it's not one thing to say then go to the ACLU to do it, but the ACLU has limited resources, has different priorities sometimes than you might have. So there are many ways in which that becomes a difficulty. I think your question was about the targeting of police. The targeting of police, there's one, I think in the context of my mandate, is one, the targeting of police in Dallas, where people were at a protest, is really the one that is there. Death is always, killings are always a bad thing, and I think no one should celebrate death, and I think we have to condemn killings of whenever they happen. I think that's a wrong thing. And I think what you want and wish that the police will deal with those people who've done the perpetrators of these violations, the killings that happen. What you want as well is a similar approach when it comes to the killings of black men in the U.S. A strong emphasis and a strong understanding and a strong desire that this also stops. So clearly, it's about the relationship between community and police that's not working out well. You don't want ever that animosity and that tension gets into the realm of violence, because who knows where it goes. I think everybody who have talked to wants protection from the police. And so they want the police to be safe, to protect them.